Welcome to Let It Roll, the story of how and why rock and roll happened with Ed Ward and Nate Wilcox. Welcome to the final episode of the first season of Let It Roll. I'm Nate Wilcox, and I'll be finishing up my conversation with Ed Ward about his book, The History of Rock and Roll Part 1, 1920 to 1963. This week we'll be concluding 1963 and hearing about the Lebanese restaurant that birthed surf music and saved Fender guitars. How Murray Wilson's failed musical career laid the groundwork for his son's amazing success, how Columbia Records buried Bob Dylan's first attempt to go rock and roll, the split between kids singing My Boyfriend's Back and those singing Blowing in the Wind. We'll also talk about Stevie Wonder's first hit and why you can hear someone shouting, what key in the background, the mystery of Smokey Robinson's failure to get a hit with the Supremes, and we finally get over to England and talk about the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and the revolution they triggered and would bring to America in 1964. Be sure and check out our website at letitrollpodcast.com to access the YouTube playlists and hear the music we're talking about. But now it's time to plug in those earbuds and hear what Ed has to say. You talk about the Grammys. In 1963, and it's just sort of like, what the heck? I mean, you know, I Left My Heart in San Francisco is the big winner, and
well, that makes sense. That was the best pop song of the year
of 1962. But this the rock hit was one I had never heard of, Alley Cat,
by Bent Fabric, who is a Danish middle of the road piano player. I don't know why. Well, it was because, you know, rock and roll. I mean, let's face it, Jethro Tull is one best traditional folk performance
And best metal band
in the same year.
Yeah. And so the Grammys, you know, Out of Touch in 1963 would continue that streak for decades.
At least 2018.
But you know, one thing you do talk about that's big is surf music. With we talked a little bit about the Beach Boys, but they had just a monster year surfing USA.
Well, and there was all the spinoff. See, initially, this was all about Dick Dale, who was this Lebanese kid who he and his father moved to just south of San Francisco, Los Angeles, to work in the aircraft industry, which was military stuff was really big in that whole area of the country, and there was lots and lots and lots of jobs. So the Mansours moved down there, and they had previously run a Greek restaurant, i.e. Lebanese, somewhere up in the Northeast, I guess Boston or someplace. And so young Dick, Richard Mansour, had he'd played percussion with a family band in the Greek restaurant, playing Greek tunes. And he also learned how to play the bouzouki, which is where he got that, you know, kind of picking style he did on the guitar. And he also discovered that he loved to surf and was good at it. And so he got a band together and eventually quit his job over at Lockheed or whoever it was, and opened a music store in Balboa Beach. And so he sold guitars. The Leo Fender with Fender Guitars was nearby. And here was this kid who was willing to try anything that Fender came down. Also selling lots of Fender guitars, which Fender thought was a really good idea. So because he, once again, had wanted to capture the jazz market and utterly failed. Nobody thought that a Stratocaster was a jazz instrument. In fact, I don't think anybody ever played one in a jazz context.
You still don't see it. The jazz guitar sticking with the hollow bodies. Yeah. And so, yeah, Dick Dale with Miser Lou, an enormous hit. But then the Beach Boys come along and add harmony vocals to it.
Right. Well, there was already a scene of instrumental music going on that Dick Dale had. He never thought of it as surf music, but if people told him that's what it was, he was good with that because he was a surfer. And, you know, he had these big dances in this ballroom that his father found that used to be a big band venue in the 40s. It had fallen on hard times. And so Dick Dale and the Deltones once a week, they would play a dance there, and the surfers all came, and they'd do the surfer stomp, which was basically stomp your left foot, stomp your right foot, because they were mostly pretty drunk. And so you couldn't be subtle at a Dick Dale gig. But you also, it was simple music. And these kids who had been buying the Fender guitars and the cheap knockoffs from Sears and so forth, they went, oh, I could do that. All you need to do is write a melody, play it a couple of times, write a bridge, and then go out with the melody, you know, a couple minutes. And all of a sudden, these surf bands started springing up because Dale was selling records, and all these hungry guys who ran tiny little record labels in Los Angeles, they wanted a piece of that. So they started coming. And so by the time of the famous fishing trip, when Dennis Wilson and Mike Love went fishing, and Dennis said, you know, there's all of these surf records, but they're all instrumental. Nobody is singing about surf music. Yeah, we ought to try to write some songs because surfing is fun. Dennis ought to know. He was the only guy in the group who surfed. And also, they'd been playing music together with Carl Wilson leading a kind of white kid doo-wop group called Carl and the Passions. So, and Brian had been, you know, learning how to compose, and he'd been learning about harmonies because he loved a lot of these people like the High Lows and the Four Freshmen. And so he was ready for this. And, oh, so we write songs. They could have written songs about, you know, vegetable farming as far as he was concerned. He just wanted to write songs and harmonize them and produce them. And so here they are in the garage, you know, recording this tune with a paper box, a cardboard box that Brian's playing drums on, surfing. And it turns out to be a huge hit.
Yeah, because their dad comes home from the weekend away and sees what they've done with the money he left him to eat. They rented music and recorded this track. And he goes all in, invests in them, puts them in the station wagon on tour.
He had a career as a failed musician. And he also, but while he was trying to not fail, he made all these connections. He knew people at Capitol. He knew some other people in Hawthorne there who had a recording studio and had some success with records that they had written and produced. So he pulled in some of his favors and they recorded more Beach Boys tunes. And eventually they took off and sold so much that they had to find a major label to take it over. So once again, Murray goes to Capitol Records and he goes, I got this thing. And they had just lost Frank Sinatra, Dean Martin, who sold a few records themselves. And they were desperate to find something in pop. They were doing okay with country, but they were desperate to find something in pop that they could move. And to teenagers, because teenagers bought lots and lots of records and didn't think much about it.
And the Beach Boys, you know, became huge. And then Brian Wilson writes a song, Surf City, that becomes a huge hit for Jan and Dean.
Right. Well, Jan and Dean had been around the scene forever. They'd begun with Jan and Arnie. Arnie Woo Woo Ginsburg was a very popular disc jockey there in Los Angeles. And, of course, you record a song with a disc jockey, you're probably going to get airplay. So they'd been doing that. And Dean was this art student or something. So that, yeah, they were, what was the name? Linda was the name of this record that they had made, which wasn't selling. So they decided to jump on the surf bandwagon after seeing what the Beach Boys had done. And they put out an album called Jan and Dean Take Linda Surfing. And it was as a way of going, hey, we recorded this record. Linda, you should maybe buy it. But it backfired on them. All the stuff that sold off of the record were singles of the surf tunes, which was fine with them.
Yep. And they made it go. And so, you know, the 60s music, to me, in a lot of ways, is about synthesis, with the Beatles sort of bringing all these threads together. But the Beach Boys and surf music at this point is sort of a just the weird thing going on in California. And then you have folk music on the East Coast, especially, you know, with Bob Dylan, and it seems like a complete planet removed.
Right.
But another track that I'd heard of but hadn't listened to until I read this book is this Bob Dylan Mixed Up Confusion, which is a rock record from 1963 by Bob Dylan, and it's pretty good.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's certainly comparable to everything else that was going on, and Columbia heard this. I mean, I don't know whether he snuck in the studio and recorded it or what, but I'm pretty sure that John Hammond, who had signed him and who had watched his instinct be proven that this Bob Dylan guy was somebody, he heard that and he knew exactly how the folk community felt about rock music. I mean, it was just, you know, these are the people who made Muddy Waters play an acoustic guitar at the Newport Folk Festival. You know, Bob Dylan, who was one of them, you know, a young guy, just like everybody else, he couldn't do this.
Yeah.
And it, the record was withdrawn. It was never advertised. It was never promoted. And for years, it was like really, really rare. You know, even back as recently as the 80s, there were copies going for $500.
And you know, if that's the only way you can hear it, if you're a real addict, it's worth it because it's a really good track. But Dylan puts it all together with a second album in this year, Free Will and Bob Dylan, which is the folk album.
Right. Here he is, king of the protest songs. In fact, so much that Talking John Birch Blues on there, he tried to perform that on Ed Sullivan and got censored, and Columbia had to remove that track from the record. And you know, and it was a perfect record. The cover shot by Don Hunstein shows Bob and his girlfriend Susie Rotolo walking down a street in the village in the aftermath of a snowstorm. And you know, it was just so appealing to everybody. And then you get in the into the record, in the tracks on the record, and there's great stuff on there. It's a real it. The first album, the best stuff was the folk stuff. The second album, it was all Bob. And boy, everybody went, wow, this has been bubbling under the surface. And, you know, Blowing in the Wind and you know, Peter, Paul, and Mary taking off on that. Yeah, there was a lot going on with him. But there were no electric instruments involved. It was felt that there was a purity. And this purity and authenticity bugbear that the folk community had, that would blow up in their faces fairly soon. But for the moment, there were radicals writing in to Sing Out magazine, which was the Bible of the folk movement. And they said, wait a minute, not all electric music is bad. Chuck Berry records blues. And some of it, he's completely on electric instruments. Muddy Waters plays blues, and he's from the Mississippi Delta, and he knew Robert Johnson. You know, we can't exclude this stuff. And everybody went, oh, brother, you know, that's really not authentic. Muddy Waters is selling out. Chuck Berry is beyond the pale.
Yeah, it almost reminds me of the split these days between Clinton voters and Bernie Sanders voters or Trump voters. It's this sort of elite East Coast, upper middle class segment that looks down on everybody else and doesn't want to be.
I don't know how upper middle class, although yes, it was largely out of colleges, and colleges did cost money. I don't think many state universities, you know, were hotbeds of folkies. It was more places like the University of Chicago and Columbia and NYU and places in Philadelphia. I mean, Philadelphia had an immense folk festival, very important. And of course, Harvard and all the colleges up there in Boston.
Yeah, at Newport. One thing you talk about is the split between people who are singing and playing Blowing in the Wind and people who are singing along with My Boyfriend's Back and You're Going to Be in Trouble. And you talk about that as a pretty big divide.
It's a class difference. It's a class difference. You know, I mean, folkies, when they hear My Boyfriend, they look at the cover of Free Will and Bob Dylan. And these other, you know, working class kids, the kids that I grew up with, I mean, boy, they were totally scandalized by the Beatles, you know. What are those faggots? Look at their hair. They're not good like the Four Seasons.
Yeah, yeah. But the Beatles, you know, overwhelm them. Before we get back to the Beatles, though, I want to talk a little bit, you know, about what the old rockers are doing. You talk about Chuck Berry doing Talking About You, which is a great song.
Yeah.
It doesn't get any traction.
Well, you know, he was, by that point, he was a little shall we say, controversial. And his Mann Act trial had been going on forever and ever. And I think the Chess Boys were still pretty much behind him, but he, like Jerry Lee Lewis, he kept doing terrible things to his career. And I think also the public was going, are we going to want to buy records by this guy who's doing sex crimes?
Yeah.
And I also think that, you know, teenagers were a little put off by that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when the guy's going to jail for taking minors across the state lines, it's not a good selling point for a pop artist. You also had Elvis, which you don't talk about what Elvis was doing that year, but he was doing some killer tracks by Pomus and Schumann, like Marie's the Name and The Name of My Latest Flame and a couple others that, I mean, the King still had it. He wasn't a king anymore, but he's still doing.
Well, he was trying to become a movie star. I mean, he realized that was better than, you know, sitting in a bus and going from gig to gig with a band, which he still enjoyed doing. But if you could live in Beverly Hills, show up for work for a certain number of days, and then go into the studio and record some music, that's a much easier life. And Elvis, having known hardship as a child, you know, he was into an easy life.
No doubt, no doubt. And then I want to cover some more of the Phil Spector stuff that was coming out that year. He did the Do Run Run with the Crystals, a Barry Greenwich song. Just a monster, monster track.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, he had good ears, and he also had the Aldon people, you know. And Aldon, by this point, had been bought by Screen Gems Music and had a big presence on the West Coast. So Spector knew that he could get quality material. Ellie Greenwich and Jeff Barry were, I think they may have moved. Carole King and Jerry Goffin were living in New York. But no matter where Phil went, there was always somebody waving a bunch of, you know, what's the word I'm looking for here?
Great material.
No, I lead sheets.
Lead sheets, yeah.
Of they were waving lead sheets of great songs in his face. Phil, look at this. Take a look at this.
Yeah, and he brings stuff like the Goffin King, then he Kiss Me track to just incredible life.
Yeah.
And, you know, and setting a template. And then
and there weren't even such a thing as the Crystals. I mean, there was the Crystals, but then if inspiration struck on the West Coast, well, he had Crystals there too.
yeah. He'd record with Darlene Love, and the Crystals would hear their new single on the radio before
right.
they ever heard it.
Do you remember doing that? No, I don't remember doing that.
and it's funny, you know, looking back on it, the aesthetic of the Beatles, where it's self-contained, the Beatles and Bob Dylan, self-contained band, self-contained songwriters, becomes so dominant in the 60s. It's weird to think that in 63, somebody the same age as John Lennon, like Phil Spector, is doing this complete assembly line with anonymous singers that are interchangeable. And
once again, this was the way it was done. This was the best minds, and they really had a track record, because not only were they selling in the United States, but they were selling elsewhere. You know, they were selling in Canada. They were selling in England. They knew this was the way to do it because, well, look at the balance sheet here.
Yeah, the track record. And Motown's doing the same thing. And probably the apotheosis of Motown in 1963 is Stevie Wonder's Fingertips Part 2, which was recorded live with the Motown House Band. It's just an incredible...
That wasn't the Motown House Band. That was a touring band.
Touring band. But some of the guys from the Motown House Band were in it.
Well, yeah, I think they had to have at least some of the guys from the Funk Brothers on the road to give it that authentic sound.
Yeah, and
but this was like a complete accident, Fingertips. They were recording the Motortown Review, and Barry thought that maybe the hit that he really hadn't had yet from Stevie was in his set. And he had this, he'd recorded an instrumental album of harmonica instrumentals, and one of them was a tune called Fingertips, I think because he played a chromatic harmonica, and the little slide that changes the reeds you're dealing with. It's done by your fingertips. Anyway, so Stevie used fingertips as his last number, and but it was like 5 or 6 minutes long. But they found a good place to edit it, and they got 2 3-minute sides and put it out as Fingertips Part 1 and Part 2. And Part 2 is where he's whipped the crowd up. And so you immediately descend on this chaos that's going on in this auditorium in Chicago. Stevie's got everybody clapping their hands, and he's twiddling around on the harmonica, and he's saying, goodbye, goodbye, you know, I gotta go now. And he's walking off the stage slowly, and people are clapping their hands and yelling. And, you know, the whole thing is just like you're listening to a slow motion explosion going on. And then he comes back on stage, surprising the band, who have been, you know, taking their instruments down and setting up for the Marvelettes. And Stevie is back on stage with a band that's half his and half the Marvelettes. And the bass player's going, what key? What key? You know, because I got to play this tune I've never heard before. I thought I was getting ready for the girls, you know. So that's what I'm getting paid for. So the whole thing is just chaos. But it coalesces there at the last moment. And then Stevie plays through another couple of choruses. This was a top 10 record, obviously.
Yeah, it was a huge hit. But, you know, Motown was hitting on all cylinders. You had Marvin Gaye with Pride and Joy. You had Smokey Robinson and the Miracles with You Really Got a Hold on Me. And we haven't talked about Smokey, but he had been kind of Berry Gordy's right-hand man, you know, the lead songwriter for Motown in a lot of ways. But he couldn't get a hit with the Supremes. They try with Breathtaking Guy and flop again.
Yeah, but he was also one of Berry's best friends. I mean, this is why he was a vice president of Motown when that title meant absolutely nothing. Berry had been aware of them because his sister, Berry's sister, Anna, had been in the music business via her own label distributed by Chess. And there's always been this rivalry between Chicago and Detroit, with Detroit on the losing end up until this point. And the Miracles made a couple of records for Chess. Their first record was Got a Job, which Smokey wrote as an answer record to the Silhouettes' Get a Job. And it didn't sell. And I believe Bad Girl was also released on Chess. And that's the kind of song that has just enough novelty and just enough of an unusual presentation that Berry's going, I got to get these boys a deal. But meanwhile, he's got no money. He's dealing with Jackie Wilson. And so, of course, when he starts thinking Detroit talent, he goes after the Miracles. So Smokey's been around for a long time.
Yeah, hits big with Shop Around. And
right.
The first, I think, number two hit for Motown.
Right.
And by 1963, I mean, You Really Got a Hold of Me is a masterpiece.
Right.
This absolute brilliant songwriting, brilliant performance, huge influence on John Lennon and the Beatles across the sea. But he can't get a hit for the Supremes.
Right. And who knows why that is? Because they were doing some pretty good records. I have no explanation for that. I've heard a lot of the early, I've heard the Primettes recordings and so forth. I've heard Buttered Popcorn, which is a really out there kind of record for who the Supremes later became. You're not going to perform that at the Copa, for goddamn sure.
No, but, you know, you take a track like Breathtaking Guy that Smokey wrote for the Supremes that did nothing, you put it on a playlist with this other stuff, and it holds its own. I mean, you do not... It does not sound like a clunker. It's just a big mystery. But
well, they could have been putting out too many records. I mean, how many records do you want to add from Motown this week? I mean, come on. Yeah. We've got to give these other guys a chance.
And they're competing with things like Heatwave, a Holland Dozier Holland song from Martha and the Vandellas. It's an absolute monster.
Right.
And very hard to beat. But you talk about the Chicago-Detroit rivalry. And Chicago, of course, is the home of Curtis Mayfield, who come back in with a huge hit. After kind of some years in the wilderness after Jerry Butler leaves them, And the stuff Mayfield is doing, not only with the impressions, but also with Major Lance, is just about as good as soul gets.
Yeah, that's the church being there in 3D, definitely. Curtis, between his guitar style, which is clearly influenced by Roebuck Staples, the Staples singers being the big and completely unique. They didn't sound like anybody else, but he was the big cheese in Chicago gospel at that point. And so Curtis, when he realizes that that's the way to go, he starts writing songs in that kind of mode, that way of presentation, the sort of filigreed simple guitar. And
the high registers, it almost reminds me of West African guitar or something.
Yeah.
It's very different from, the bass heavy guitar you hear on a lot of other soul records. But one thing before we're going to get to the Beatles and the Stones in a minute to wrap up the year, but Trini Lopez this is another thing that I'd heard his version of If I Had a Hammer before, but I'd never really paid any attention. I read this book, start listening to that album they recorded live, and that's a pretty amazing rock and roll record. I had thought of him as a folkie because of If I Had a Hammer being a folk song, but he's really...
He's a nightclub performer.
Yeah.
He's not, and he's playing on the Sunset Strip, so his audience is a lot of show business people, and he's got to keep it up to the moment because, you know, it's Los Angeles. Come on.
Yeah. But it also, when you listen to that album, and if you just re-listen to his version of If I Have a Hammer, you hear the Latin inflections, the Latin beat, and you sort of realize Trini Lopez is kind of the heir to Ritchie Valens.
Right.
And the bridge to Johnny Rivers later on, that Latin American music is a big part of the rock and roll story, but it kind of floats underground, I think, because Ritchie Valens died and didn't become that great star.
Right. I mean, and earlier people like Don Tosti weren't going to be, you know, because they sang in Spanish a lot of the time. You know, and they recorded things like Marijuana Boogie.
Yeah.
They weren't going to be top of the pops anytime soon. And, of course, also, the Latin scene in America has always been divided into three markets. New York's Puerto Rican, Afro-Cuban stuff, which is a lot of jazz-influenced. The Texas, Tejano, San Antonio-based sound. And then the West Coast... also Chicano sound, but since the Mexican population of Los Angeles and the Mexican population of Texas came from two different Mexican states, the musical traditions are different. So you get mariachi in Texas, not in Los Angeles. And also, there were no crossovers between those three markets. So the numbers were really small, so nobody was paying attention to that. It was only when Bob Keane decided that Ritchie Valens was worth getting behind that anything happened.
Yeah, and then he tried.
And also, it's notable that Trini Lopez is from Texas.
I didn't know that. And but that is a great album and really a lot of fun. But one record I want to talk about that you didn't bring up is Ronnie Hawkins and the Hawks doing this killer version of Who Do You Love by Bo Diddley with Robbie Robertson on completely unhinged, distortion-soaked lead guitar.
Yeah, I completely missed Ronnie Hawkins. I mean, he was not on New York radio, and that's what I was listening to at the time. I don't know that I wonder where he sold. Also, he was on Roulette, which was a mob label out of New York.
Yeah.
And yet they couldn't get him on the radio there. So where were records like that selling? I don't know.
I don't know that it sold anywhere, but the thread I want to connect it to is James Feld, who was the roommate of the Rolling Stones, in his memoirs talks about the time when he's living with Mick Jagger, Brian Jones, and Keith Richards in this hovel in Edith Grove, London, where he talks about they acquire this pile of records. They've gone to a radio station and stolen, which is a Brian Jones habit, stolen a big pile of records, and they're going through it, and there's some things they knew and some things they didn't. And they get down to the bottom of it, and there's this Ronnie Hawkins record they never heard of. Brian Jones puts it on and just will not take it off the turntable and is utterly obsessed with this roaring sound. And so their second single, which you talk about the Stones a lot in this chapter, and I think it's appropriate, but you don't mention the slide guitar that Brian Jones puts on I Want to Be Your Man, which is a Lennon McCartney song. And that's, you know, the big threat is Lennon McCartney are becoming not just successes with the Beatles, but successes as songwriters and dominating
right.
British pop.
Which is the same thing that Brian Wilson was doing. He was just giving away, not giving away, he was obviously going to get royalties on it, but he's just giving away stuff that he could have done for his own band. Same with Lennon and McCartney. But yeah, I mean, Who Do You Love is like, there's never been another song like it. It is completely surrealistic. God knows where Bo Diddley got those lyrics. First time I heard it, it was by it was on a version by John Hammond, John Hayes Hammond, John Hammond Jr. And hardly the most impressive recording of it, although it did have the band as a backup.
Yeah, Robbie Robertson and company.
Yeah, and yet, it scared me even in his version. When I heard the original Bo Diddley version, that was really something.
Yeah, the lyrics are straight up voodoo. I mean,
yeah, where did that come from? Well, you know, I disagree with all these people who talk about the great voodoo connection to rhythm and blues music, because voodoo was not practiced outside of New Orleans and certain places in Florida. It was not practiced in the United States. Where that stuff came from, I don't know. We could go to Jung or something and talk about collective unconscious.
Well, it's tied to the Pentecostal stuff, I think. And the I don't know if what your hillbilly roots are like. Mine are pretty deep. And when I hear versions of that old-time religion, sometimes I get the feeling that the old-time religion they're talking about predates Christianity.
Oh, yeah.
And it can become very spooky. And you've got, you know, Robert Johnson singing about Hellhound on My Trail and things like that. So there's this undercurrent. And that's written into books that people like Brian Jones are reading around this time. And so there's this real mythology of linking the blues and devil worship. And somebody like Brian Jones...
Not devil worship, but alternative saints, let's put it that way.
Yeah. And somebody like Brian Jones, who's frankly a bad egg. He's been run out of Cheltenham for knocking up, you know, virtually every girl in town. Been fired from every record store in London for pilfering... you know, from the till, and these
kicked
two...
out of Alexis Corner's house where he'd been sleeping under the table. I mean, yeah, he was a bad egg.
Yeah, and he's a little bit older than Keith Richards and Mick Jagger, who come from Dartford, come to the Ealing Club, see him doing "Dust My Broom," the Elmore James song with Paul Jones later, "Man for Man," singing, are completely blown away by him. Move into this apartment with him. Keith Richards spends 8 hours a day playing guitar and listening to Jimmy Reed records with Brian. Mick Jagger's insanely jealous. At one point, Keith and Brian are doing an Everly Brothers duet, which I can only imagine.
Boy, I'd like to hear that. Like. Maybe not.
Yeah. But nonetheless, he imbues the Stones with this ethos. And somebody is kind of a forgotten figure, weirdly. But I like the way that you focused on him as the architect of what the Stones were doing.
Well, he's the guy who made inroads into that sector of the trad jazz scene in London with Alexis Corner and his, you know, little rhythm and blues novelty act in between sets of the larger band. And you know, he impressed Alexis with his guitar playing, which, you know, for a teenager, that's pretty good, because Alexis has been working on this for a long time. And also, you know, Alexis is bringing people like Muddy Waters.
Big Bill Brunzy.
Yeah, Big Bill Brunzy, but Muddy in particular with his electric outfit to London to perform and telling people that it's jazz.
And sneaking it in. And I think that's an important point that you talk about. London didn't really have a rock scene. They had some stuff, the Dave Clark Five and Tottenham out on the fringes, but there's nothing comparable to what's going on in Liverpool, where they have dozens of rock clubs and hundreds
right.
of bands. London doesn't have anything, and the Stones kind of sneak into the trad jazz scene and take over.
Right. Well, it got to the point where I believe I mentioned a jazz festival somewhere where... once the Rolling Stones have formed, they're performing, and 50% of the audience shows up to see them and leaves after their set is over, leaving all these other jazz musicians who are supposedly, you know, big dogs on the London scene with a half-filled house.
Yeah, and one thing I think you get across, and also comes across in the Stones documentary Crossfire Hurricane by Martin Scorsese, is how calculated they were. They knew they were pretty boys. They knew they were charismatic. And Brian Jones had this weird vision that he could take hardcore blues like Jimmy Reed, also Bo Diddley and Chuck Berry, but Muddy Waters and Reed and things like that that were in no way, shape, or form seen as commercial potential. And somehow he knew that that was the next big thing.
They were selling. I mean, Jimmy Reed was selling records in the United States. Once again, a guy who was taken up by rank-and-file college students. Once again, I'm back to my dorm in 1965, and almost everybody had Jimmy Reed live.
That's the sort of thing you don't know growing up decades later. But one thing I think that's important is that the Stones were conceived independent of the Beatles. You talk about them being bummed out when they hear Love Me Do on the radio. And I think it's very important because the Stones influence rock and roll in a way. The Beatles are enormous, but they're not the template for the future rock bands.
Right. Well, one is coming out of a pop tradition, no matter how weird the angle is that they're coming off of it as, and the others are coming out of a long tradition of jazz and blues, even though they're British. As you said, Brian Jones sees them as possessing a degree of authenticity that these other guys don't have. It isn't until the Beatles are in London recording and go to the Crawdaddy Club and see this band that everybody's been talking about while they've been in London, and they go, oh, these guys are interesting. And then they go back to Edith Grove and spend the whole rest of the night playing records and, you know, not even leaving until the sun comes back up. So there was a commonality there. And I think both parties then agreed, well, this town is big enough for the two of us.
Yeah. I mean, the Stones blow away the Mercy Beat followers that the Beatles had brought in their wake, the Billy J. Kramers and the Jerry and the Pacemakers.
Well, they do here, but they certainly didn't in England.
Not in 63, no. But if you put I Want to Be Your Man on a shuffle with a 1963 playlist, it sounds like Black Flag or Early Metallica. It is amazingly raunchy and loud, and you really get a feel for how radical the Stones were.
And yet it didn't sell, and Jagger hated it.
Yeah. But it did make it number 12 on the charts, and that kept their momentum
that's
going.
That's purchasable.
Yeah. That's and Andrew
10
Lou Goldham,
and up, it's a little harder.
Yeah, and Andrew Lou Goldham, their manager, has a couple of great memoirs, Stoned and Stoned 2, that talks about the chicanery he went through to get those records on the charts. And, you know, Brian Epstein, the Beatles manager, is constantly accused of having bought Love Me Do into the charts. But Mark Lewisohn and his definitive bio of the Beatles, Tune In, debunks that pretty thoroughly.
Sure, because they were an actual organic phenomenon. You know, you don't need to buy your way into the charts when you've got, I don't know, how many kids do you suppose there were in Liverpool and Manchester? Once again, a tale of rivalry, you know, and kids in the North who had seen them, you know, playing on these short tours that they'd done. How many kids do you think were waiting for the words, there is a Beatles record, to come across and rush to your local record store and buy it?
It seems to be everybody who saw them live. I mean, the impression you get in the stories, you know, and it's well documented, they would play someplace, 25 people would show up, they'd play there again, it'd be 200 people.
Right.
Next time it's 1,000 people. I mean, the Beatles were this enormous phenomenon, just a real sui generis thing that amazing charisma and talent and work ethic that just compelled people, and their timing was amazing.
Yeah, well, that was something nobody could have chosen,
you know,
including the Kennedy assassination in America.
Yeah, they come, and I'm sure you'll talk about it in Volume 2, they come across as sort of the antidote to the depression of the Kennedy assassination. Here's something new, bright, shiny, foreign.
Yeah, it's pop. It isn't at all looking into the abyss of Who Do You Love?
Yeah, there's none of the Jerry Lee Lewis, Elvis. There's no, the connection, they're music's descended from the Deep South in a way. I mean, they're into things like Ray Charles.
But they're also into Goffin and King. I mean, when they came to America, The reporter says, "Is there anybody you want to meet here?" And Lennon immediately says, "Jerry Goffin and Carole King."
Yep. And then Oz also talks up Smokey Robinson as his favorite
songwriter.
And they look very, they're mod, they're continental European fashion. It does not look threatening. It looks funny to Americans.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Oh, yeah, and we got to give credit to Brian Epstein for that, because as a gay, cosmopolitan, Jewish guy with a lot of connections in London, he had a good eye for fashion, and he knew how important that was for pop singers.
Yeah, and he got them out of their leather suits, which were awesome, but way too much for
if they'd come off the plane in New York wearing leather suits, I don't think. Well, the girls were already screaming, so who knows?
Yeah, who knows? But Epstein packaged them brilliantly, and that's one thing. You know, Brian Epstein definitely, I don't think, gets enough credit. He died in 1967 tragically, but the Beatles had a really almost miraculous ability to attract not only high performance people, but well-meaning people.
Yeah.
And Epstein and George Martin, these guys looked after the boys.
Right.
And you don't get that much in pop music.
Right. You don't. Well, you have to have a certain amount of self-interest. And Brian's self-interest was that he didn't want to really go into the family business of selling furniture and electronics. So much as he liked, after his first visit to the cavern, he was really taken by the energy. He liked that teenage energy, which he had sort of missed growing up as a misfit kid. And, you know, Martin was in deep trouble. He had been a star producer, and then he had gotten divorced and hooked up. I don't think he even married her. His secretary. He'd been having an affair with...
He couldn't get divorced. I don't think his wife would grant him the divorce.
Right. And so here was this guy who was making Decca look bad.
Yeah, EMI. This is one of the great revelations in the Lewisons book, that Martin was basically blackmailed into taking the Beatles.
Right.
By the publishing wing of EMI, Ardmore and Beechwood. And Mark Lewison, in his amazing book, Tune In, talks about the A&R guy at Ardmore and Beechwood and all the work he did to break Love Me Do. And yet the first thing George Martin does when he has his epiphany and realizes the Beatles are really something is cut those guys out and bring in Dick James as the publisher.
Well, Dick James was a lot hungrier than the EMI publishers were.
Yeah, for sure.
And Martin knew, I mean, you know, let's face it, he had all the cards. He now had a hit, and he had this group that was going to produce more hits because they were already writing songs like a faucet that you couldn't turn off. And so it was time to get somebody in who would be your pet publisher.
Yeah, and the advantage he had was Epstein and the Beatles knew him, and they didn't know the backstory.
Right.
And they thought that he had been the guy that brought him in, and they did work with him well. They had a real amazing chemistry. And Dick James and the Beatles publishing deal gets a lot of, you know, revisionist criticism. But actually, this deal that James put together to form their own publishing company and give them a 50% ownership stake in it was really progressive for the time, especially for a group that had one hit song.
Right. But I think, like Martin, he knew that there was more where that came from. And it's better to have, you know, 50% of $1 million than all of $10,000.
Yeah. And so, you know, and so this thread of the Beatles and the Stones sort of rumbles as an undercurrent throughout your chapter on 1963 music. And you talk about the impeccable timing of the Beatles. Somebody with bad timing was Phil Spector, who pours his heart and soul into this Christmas album. You know, that testimonial he has at the beginning of the album.
Right.
And yet, it's all washed away by the Kennedy assassination. It was like the year without a Christmas, basically.
Well, he was luckier than Von Meter was. Meter was the guy who did the First Family, and which was a really brilliant comedy album about, you know, the Kennedys. And it was at one point during the year selling faster than any LP had ever sold. I mean, it was ubiquitous. Everybody I knew had a copy of it, even people who hated Democrats, because it was funny.
Yeah.
And Meter's accent was right on. He was from Maine, so he knew how to speak in the kind of Kennedy style. So, you know, here's this great hit. Meter actually was very lucky. He worked as a New England dialect comedian in New England and continued to live in Maine and was very successful as a comedian, but not as a superstar.
Yeah, and so, you know, the fall of Camelot had an enormous impact on the American psyche, and the Beatles jumped in. I mean, it really is a perfect place to split this history of rock and roll, because America before 63 and after are very different countries.
And the other thing that I always emphasize when I talk about why did you end the book here is the AFO executives driving to Los Angeles. AFO was a collective. It stands for All for One, that Harold Batiste, who is a trumpet player and a arranger-composer in New Orleans, had put together. He was influenced by the Nation of Islam and the whole black Muslim thing into going for black power in the record industry. And so he set up this AFO studio band and record label and collective, and he worked with all kinds of people. Ellis Marsalis made a bunch of records for him, and he had real high ideals and worked with Pete Fountain and Al Hurt on trying to integrate the Black Musicians Union and the White Musicians Union, and even with the two best-selling artists in New Orleans backing him up, the old school racists wouldn't do anything. So that was that. They decided, I mean, I heard this at the last Ponderosa Stomp, which was 2 years ago in New Orleans. And the bass player, whose name I don't remember, was there. He talked about it. He said, Harold came into a meeting of the executives. He said, how many cars we got? And they said, two, but they're station wagons. He says, good, here's what we're going to do. We're going to move to Los Angeles to get studio work. I've had it with these people. And all of a sudden, the studio musicians who made that great sound in New Orleans were gone.
And went out to L.A.
Yeah. Well, not only did they immediately work their way into the scene there, but they created this vacuum in New Orleans, which would have to be filled because there were a lot of singers, there were a lot of songwriters, and they needed to record. Cosmo was sitting there waiting for people to book. We need some new people. So not only was the face of soul changing, not only was the face of rock and roll changing, not only was the face of pop changing, but in a smaller context, New Orleans had just been turned on its head. Yeah. So that's another thing that 1964 was going to have to deal with.
Yeah, and one of the people that immigrated was Earl Palmer, the great rock drummer who goes out to L.A., and he and Hal Blaine kind of duel back and forth as the lead drummer in the Wrecking Crew. So many hits in L.A. with those guys playing drums the rest of the decade.
And yet, the very first session they did was Sonny and Cher. And Batiste, I mean, he heard Sonny sitting at the piano going, do, 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 do. And he goes, kid, you got to write a verse for that. Because we can turn this into a song. He got no credit. He was willing to be known as somebody who would help you as a doctor on your unfinished idea. And, you know, Sherilyn Sarkosian is sitting there waiting for her cue. And Sonny is still writing the song. And the studio time, you know, excuse me, studio time is being wasted while Sonny takes his half-cooked idea.
Yeah.
And Batiste goes, come on, kid, we can do this.
Yeah, and Carole Kaye, I think, throws in the bass line. That's the hook. And Sonny is somebody who's been sort of a gopher for Phil Spector.
And a talent scout for Specialty Records.
Yeah, and so... in a way, Phil Spector had this opportunity to be sort of a Motown, but he couldn't let go enough. He had to control everything himself.
Right, exactly.
And so people like Sonny and Cher slipped through his fingers. Which...
Right. I mean, there's no reason whatever that he couldn't have recorded them.
Yeah, and had a second act. In
well, but also, I mean, he already had tons and tons and tons of acts and records, and he wasn't real big on people writing their own material, because look at all these people he could get from Aldon,
yeah,
from Screen Gems.
And he
Come
could
on.
Join in and get a co-writing credit.
Right.
And
legitimately, because he really was a songwriter.
Yeah, and I want to talk a little bit more about the Christmas album, though, because I really find the dedication he puts on that poignant and touching, in especially in light of his ultimate fate. You know, Phil Spector's in prison today, which,
right,
you know, somebody died, he killed him, and that's justice. But it's still very sad to think that somebody who had this kind of sensitivity and gave the world so much happiness is such a miserable, cursed person.
Right. But, I mean, that was a wonderful album. And, you know, if some of the social tsunamis hadn't happened, it would have been remembered a lot better. I mean, really, that album didn't actually start to be listened to seriously until about 1970. I mean, Rolling Stone ran a review of it, and it had already been out for 5 years.
Yeah, and it eventually
and
did.
Nobody had heard of it, and you could go down to your local drugstore and find it in the cutout bins, along with all the rest of the Phil Spector stuff, which wasn't nearly as good. This was an album. This was Phil learning to make an album, which almost nobody did back then. Of course, he had a concept, which was Christmas.
Yeah.
And some of it was old chestnuts like Frosty the Snowman, and some of it he wrote himself.
Yeah, and brought in Aldon songwriters, too, to work with him. And you know, if that had been a hit, it makes you wonder what other albums Phil might have done throughout the 60s.
But would he have grown with the ways of the oncoming, you know, the kind of thinking?
Yeah, the self-contained band.
Right. I don't think he would have dug that. He had spent his entire teenage life learning from Lieber and Stoller, from Snuffy Garrett at Liberty Records. He learned old school music business stuff. And old school music business stuff carried on for a number of years after that.
Yeah.
But
it wasn't the cutting edge. It wasn't the future.
And it was doomed. It was old and it was dying.
Yeah. And so you end the chapter talking about a huge hit, but kind of an odd thing, Skeeter Davis's End of the World.
Yeah, well, that was a weird... That was on RCA, so they didn't have that kind of, you know, Acuff Rose Monument Records thinking and those kind of resources in terms of orchestrators and arrangers of the kind that Roy Orbison had. She was just a country chick singer who had been around for a while, and yet they found this song. I don't remember who wrote it. Did she write it herself? I don't think so.
She might have. We have to look.
I mean,
into
it's
that.
It's like It's My Party, I'll Cry If I Want To. In it's a teenage girl saying, you know, how can all of these wonderful things in the world keep on going on and ignore the fact that I'm heartbroken? And it's a stupid thought that she completely carries off.
Yeah, and in the context of the Kennedy assassination, I think
the song hit in the early part of the year. I just used it because I thought it was a good title for the chapter.
Ah, yes, and it is very fitting. So
because it is, it's the end of a lot of people's worlds, including Phil Spector's.
Yeah, and only 23 years old, he's going to have some more monumental hits with the Righteous Brothers, and then a monumental flop with Ike and Tina Turner. And then go on to seclusion, come back with the Beatles. But he's never really Phil Spector again after 1963.
Right.
Not in the same way. And so that's our chapter, 1963. We'll be back with more of these.
Thanks for listening. That's the end of our first season. We hope you've enjoyed listening to Ed Ward and I talk about musical history. I'll be back in 2018 with more music talk, so stay tuned for that. Be sure and check out our website at letitrollpodcast.com to access the YouTube playlists and hear the music we're talking about. If you're enjoying the show and you want to learn more about the history of rock and roll, buy Ed's book, The History of Rock and Roll, Volume 1, 1920 to 1963, published by Flatiron Books, available on Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, and anywhere fine books are sold.